Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go. Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage.
Hi, friends, and welcome back to the Saturday Frights podcast. We have a pretty creepy offering for you this time. Episode 10 of Season 2 from HBO's Tales from the Crypt TV series entitled The Ventriloquist's Dummy. If you're a fan of the show, or check out any of the stuff posted on the Saturday Frights Facebook page, or what we share on Twitter, or the Poltergeist episode of the podcast, you might have realized that I do not care for dolls or ventriloquist dummies that much. In fact, they totally creep me out. Which is, of course, why I'm positive that the projectionist picked this very episode. Am I close on that guess, my friend?
It never ceases to amaze me. And just how often you attempt to paint me as the villain.
Maybe that's because when I'm hanging out with you down here in the Retros Vault, I have a tendency to suffer head injuries, projectionist.
Coincidence, my boy. You were quite clumsy. I chose this episode because the Retroist himself requested it on the Facebooks.
He did? I didn't see that on the main page.
I recall there was some type of power outage at the Facebooks, and it erased the message. Yes, that is what happened.
That isn't how Facebook works, projectionist. If the Retroist posted this episode request, then it would show up, unless he decided to delete.
We are getting off subject, aren't we, dear listeners? Sage, you better get to the synopsis, or we will be here all evening.
Well, friends, since this is a TV episode, please remember we'll be giving a full synopsis. So if you haven't had the pleasure of watching it for yourself yet, you might want to pause and seek it out. I believe you can find this Tales from the Crypt episode online. The Ventriloquist's Dummy originally aired on June 5th, 1990, and was directed by Richard Donner, who has had a few hit films like Superman and The Goonies. It was written by none other than Frank Darabont, who directed a little film called The Shawshank Redemption and brought The Walking Dead to AMC. Much to his regret, I imagine. Anyway, as the episode opens, we find ourselves in a smoky nightclub, filled with uproarious laughter from its patrons. They are cackling madly thanks to the ventriloquist act currently on the stage, which is how we meet Mr. Ingalls, played by Don Rickles, who is in fine form, by the way. And I promise you, the moments in his act where he is heckling the members of the audience are ad-libbed. I mean, Rickles is well known for that.
Very seriously, I'm looking around and I see the food that's on the tables. There's flies are starting to die right on the plates.
How's the food in this place, huh?
Don't eat. I brought my girl here for dinner last night and she found a bug in her soup.
Oh, that's terrible. What happened?
She yelled, "Waiter, remove this insect at once."
And?
The guy threw me out.
That was a good one, huh, lady? The old broad came alive. I've been up here a half hour, and the old broad finally went, "That was a good one, Lou. Stop coughing when I'm delivering funny lines. Put yourself in a hospital and just lay there with the covers open and let the nurse stare at you."
In attendance of the performance is a young boy named Billy Goldman, who is absolutely captivated by not just Mr. Ingalls ripping into the audience, but of course his skill at working his wooden companion, who is named Morty. After the show, a young Billy excitedly tells Mr. Ingalls that he plans on becoming a ventriloquist as well, which his mother insists will never happen, as she plans on him becoming a doctor. Not wanting to dampen the mood after signing an autograph, the older man tells the young boy that he can look him up if he ever needs advice on ventriloquism. While the young boy and his family leave the club, it seems that Mr. Ingalls has a hot date. Except he begs off, telling the woman he isn't feeling very well. But Morty pipes up that she needs to meet him at his private bungalow. As the woman leaves, we, the audience, can't help but pick up on how worried Ingalls looks. That night, while little Billy is practicing ventriloquism in his bed, giving it all he has, he hears a commotion outside. Through the reflection on his bedroom window, we can see a raging fire destroying a bungalow. We can hear people frantically calling for help and asking if there was anyone within the building. The answer to that will have to wait 15 years. That is when a now grown Billy Goldman, played by the excellent Bobcat Goldthwait, has decided to take up the offer Mr. Ingalls extended when he was just a boy. The problem is that the ventriloquist has become something of a recluse. Billy, with his own dummy in hand, named Tim, knocks on the door of Mr. Ingalls' rundown place, and is immediately berated from within by the older man. There is yellowing newspaper on all the windows, but Billy is persistent, shouting through the door and letting us know that it's taken him 3 days driving, and he refuses to leave until he has a chance to chat with Ingalls. While clearly annoyed beyond belief, which Rickles does very well, the older man lets Billy into his home. Now, I might be getting a little ahead of myself, but Billy is a very sympathetic character. Bobcat plays him as this lovable goof-up, but as soon as he's let into Ingalls' place, he starts going through his stuff, touching old photos, and even trying to pull down the ventriloquist dummy box for Morty that is high up on a shelf.
Rather rude, to say the least. Not to mention showcasing Billy's lack of character.
Yeah, agreed. Though I think we're supposed to take it that Billy is just so excited to be meeting his idol. Anyway, that is when Billy sees that Mr. Ingalls has kept a newspaper clipping. It seems that the fire 15 years ago killed not only Mr. Ingalls' date, but his career. We then notice that Ingalls keeps his right hand covered in a special glove, almost like a mitt. Billy innocently asks why the older man couldn't use his left hand, but Ingalls angrily explains that all of the magic, as he calls it, was in his right. He offers he doesn't even recall now how the fire got started. The way Rickles plays the character, gruff and off-putting to be certain, but you can see that in a weird way he's glad to have company since his forced retirement. Not that I mean he starts to be nice to Billy. The young man explains the reason he came all this distance was that he's going to perform at a nearby club at an amateur night and hoped Mr. Ingalls would attend his performance. The older man tries to explain that he just doesn't leave the house, but seeing Billy so anxious, wanting acceptance from his idol, and trust me, friends, I've had the displeasure of meeting one of my absolute idols and being dismissed.
Who was this?
Calm down, projectionist. It's not important. Seeing Billy looking so dejected causes the older man to warm to him. And to the young man's delight, that evening he sees his idol walk into the club just before he goes on stage. Here is the extremely sad part. Billy is a horrible ventriloquist, and there is nothing funny in watching him just die up on stage. Of course, the nervousness and crushing despair is something that Bobcat really sells well. Billy is so bad that Ingalls can't bear to watch him, and after a few minutes, heads into the bar and starts to drink, where he's propositioned by a woman of ill repute. Billy joins the older man after the show, and heartbreakingly, Ingalls tells the young man that he needs to find another line of work. He is honest when he says he regrets having to tell Billy that, and the younger man accepts the truth, numbly begging forgiveness for wasting his idol's time. As Billy leaves the bar, it seems that Mr. Ingalls has a change of heart, or should I say it looks like he's fighting a battle with himself, before he wanders over to the woman of ill repute and asks if she would like a drink. Outside the club, Billy rages at himself for being a failure, smashing his ventriloquist dummy against a dumpster over and over, only ceasing when he hears a scream from nearby. Running over, he finds an elderly couple, a woman in hysterics. The reason being is we can see the young woman from the bar is sitting in a car, dead. Her throat looks to have been ravaged. Billy does the decent thing and takes off his coat to cover the poor woman's body and announces the entire car reeks of gas and that no one surrounding it should light a match. The bigger shock for the young man, though, is he recognizes the car the dead woman is laying in. It belongs to Mr. Ingalls. It was parked outside the house when Billy pulled up. The young man rushes to the older man's home, barging in to find Ingalls injecting himself with morphine. Or he tries to, before Billy takes the needle and bottle, smashing them in anger. Billy physically confronts Mr. Ingalls, demanding that the older man admit to not only the young woman's death, but that he was going to set the car on fire, like he had the bungalow 15 years earlier. Mr. Ingalls admits he was going to start the fire, but hadn't murdered the young woman. It was Morty that did it. As it dawns on Billy that his idol is obviously a madman, he tries to talk the older man down. The young man, in an attempt to help Ingalls see reason, pulls Morty's case from the shelf and begins to root through it to show that the dummy is only made of wooden cloth. Which is a poor time for Billy to turn his back, as we, the audience, can see Ingalls muttering to himself, retrieving a very large meat cleaver from the kitchen, and begins to advance on his unwanted guest. Billy pulls Morty out of the box and is shocked to see that the dummy is missing its head, which is what he almost loses when Ingalls brings down the cleaver. Billy and Ingalls wrestle for control of the weapon, but the younger man is knocked to the ground. Ingalls, brandishing the deadly weapon, informs Billy that he missed something in the box, demanding that he look closer. The frightened young man reaches in and pulls out Morty's head. Well, half of it, because it looks like a mask. Which is when Ingalls gleefully rips off the glove on his right hand, and we learn the shocking secret of his success as a ventriloquist.
Go on! Go on! You missed something! Take a look! Go ahead! Look! Look! Look at it! That's right, I'm there. Morty's like me. He's real. He's flesh and blood. In fact, Morty is my brother! My brother! He's dead! We're born like this. I guess we were meant to be twins, but nature can work in a cruel way sometimes. Rather than go through life as freaks, we decided on a career in show business.
Yeah, we decided to put our heads together. That's a joke, son. I don't see you laughing.
For 15 years, I kept them drugged up, away from the world, especially the ladies. Then you had to come along and stir things up.
Get the cleaner!
Cut him up!
Even destroyed the last of the morphine. The only thing that could calm him down. Now I can't even stop him. He's very willful.
What are you gonna do? Talk him to death? Slice him! Unzip his guts!
That is correct, listeners. Ingalls' right hand ends in the large, bulbous head of his brother Morty, who has two flipper-like appendages, with kind of pinchers at the end. We learn that Ingalls wasn't a ventriloquist, but in fact the straight man in the act. Morty, in his high-pitched cry, crows that all of the success was due to him. He even wrote the replies for Ingalls. The older man explains that he was using the morphine to keep his brother sedated. His conjoined twin hates women, since he can't have a relationship for obvious reasons. Billy now finds himself literally fighting for his life, while Morty crying out joyfully for Ingalls to chop the younger man to death, and the older man mournfully wailing that he doesn't want to, but his brother is just too willful. Billy pleads for the older man to fight his brother's desires, but Morty gloats about how horrible it's been attached to such a loser. Which is the final straw, and Ingalls brings down the cleaver, not on Billy, but on his own right arm, severing Morty from his body. Both howl out in pain as Ingalls continuously brings the cleaver down again and again. And this part of the episode is very gory, of course, but there is almost a Looney Tunes type of logic that goes into play. While Billy tries to stop the blood pumping from Ingalls' arm, Morty is racing around the kitchen mocking the two. Well, until the little murderer dashes up his brother's body and bites his throat out. This horrifying scene causes Billy to grab a baseball bat from over the fireplace and start swinging wildly at the monster. Thanks to a loose floorboard that flips Morty up into the air, Billy is able to swat the murderer across the room with the bat. The pint-sized monster bounces off a wall to land, conveniently, in a meat grinder. Billy wastes little time in pushing Morty down further, slowly cranking the handle and grinning as he grinds up the beast. Morty cries out in pain and promises he will do absolutely anything Billy asks if he will just stop, which is when a light bulb goes off for the failed ventriloquist. You guessed it, listeners. Much like the deal that Morty and his brother had, the same act brings great success to Billy. And we catch him up on stage, knocking them dead. The young man has finally achieved his dream. He holds the little beast with his right hand while performing. When a young woman walks into the club, Morty's dialogue turns rather blue, so much so that Billy begins to lose his temper and threatens Morty, who of course is wearing the ventriloquist dummy suit like before. The audience finds all of this pretty funny, but begins to sense something is definitely wrong when Billy starts to shout out in pain. Before their eyes, he manages to rip off the dummy suit, and we see that Morty has somehow fused with Billy's right hand. The episode ends with Billy and the audience screaming in terror, and Morty cackling in glee at having a new permanent partner in show business. That, friends, is the complete synopsis for the ventriloquist dummy.
This evening, before we begin broadcasting, it was my first introduction to this episode of Tales from the Crypt. I must admit, I was quite impressed.
I was able to see it when it originally aired, thanks to one of HBO's free weekends.
What is a free weekend?
Projectionist, Generally, twice a year, HBO would allow viewers to tune into a certain station, where they could watch HBO free all weekend. It was a great plan, because if you got hooked by, say, Tales from the Crypt, you would of course start thinking about becoming a subscriber. I'm not sure if they still do this, but back in the day, my family, we would buy blank tapes by the bundle and just record morning and night. We first watched The Ventriloquist Dummy at my grandparents', which, to be honest, they didn't care much for the gore. I can recall my grandmother looking away when Ingalls has his throat bitten out, but I also remember my grandfather getting quite a kick out of Don Rickles' performance. I will admit when I first watched it that until Billy pulls Morty's mask out of the trunk, I didn't have a clue where this episode was going.
Really? I felt that little surprise was telegraphed too far in advance. Even at the bar, when he is struggling to avoid hiring the Lady of the Night, Mr. Ingalls grips the covering over his right hand like he is trying to hold it down. You might be interested to know, dear listeners, Don Rickles' character's name is a tip of the hat to the famous illustrator, Graham Ingalls, although with a different spelling. Graham Ingalls was one of the original illustrators for EC Comics' Tales from the Crypt, The Haunt of Fear, and The Vault of Horror.
I can add to the list of interesting trivia for this episode, friends. You see director Richard Donner sitting in the bar beside Don Rickles after Billy's disastrous show. He's chatting with a beautiful young woman who just so happens to be Mindy Rickles, Don's real-life daughter. And also, when Ingalls and Billy are struggling over the weapon, the older man swings the cleaver and strikes a photograph on the wall, which just so happens to be a picture of John Landis. Subtle message from Richard Donner? I sure don't know, but it makes you wonder, right?
Victor, let us discuss the ending.
Go ahead.
Did it feel slapped on to you?
I see where you're going with this. Yeah, it's a little odd. But I think, like I said in the synopsis, at the end of the episode, it all plays like a dark Looney Tunes cartoon. Besides, if you can accept that Morty is running around loose without being connected to Ingalls, you know, he doesn't bleed out, etc., I think you can accept that he somehow has the ability to meld himself to Billy's hand.
I'm going to disagree. It's the only part of the episode that I found to be lacking. The acting by Don Rickles and Bobcat Goldthwait was quite enjoyable.
Well, getting two real-life stand-up comedians to play the roles is a smart choice. Of course, until the end, this entire episode is very serious. You might even say it's sad, not just with Billy's lack of talent as a ventriloquist, but the haunting regret that Ingalls carries around.
Who did the voice of Morty?
That's a question I can't answer, Projectionist. I couldn't find any record. I guess it could be John Cassier, who was the voice of the Crypt Keeper. Surely it wasn't Rickles. Listeners, if you happen to know the answer, please feel free to throw us a line. Now, before we jump into the notable cast and crew, Projectionist, do you...
I thought I had disabled that accursed caterwauling.
You did. I turned it back on.
Hey, Vic. It's Eric from Warpo Toys.
Hi, Eric. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to let you and the Saturday Frights listeners know about Warpo's new toy line, Don't Cuddle the Krampus.
Awesome! Listeners, you'll probably remember that Warpo released that great set of H.P. Lovecraft-inspired toys, The Legends of Cthulhu. A truly awesome line of figures designed to look like you had picked them up in the 1980s. So, Eric, I assume this is another 80s-inspired toy line?
Yeah, it's an all-new plush monster toy straight out of the 80s gross-out era. He has horns, claws, chains, and even a sack full of plush naughty kids.
That sounds neat, Eric. I can't wait to check it out. But why are you whispering?
Well, I wanted to get an up-close and personal look at a real-life Krampus, so I may have snuck into the Retroist vault to check out the one you captured last Christmas.
You didn't!
I did. And I may have accidentally unlocked the cage.
Oh, no! We've got to alert everyone in the Retro's vault.
Actually, no worries there, Vic. I'm pretty sure he followed me back to Warpo HQ. In fact, I'm certain he did. Uh, Uh-oh. I think he found me, Vic. Anyway, if you and your listeners want to check out Warpo's Don't Cuddle the Krampus toys, head to warpo.com/Kickstarter. Ah!
Oh no. Projectionist, what are we gonna do?
Nothing. I'm sure they'll be fine. Assuming, of course, they aren't naughty boys. Besides, look on the bright side. We've just saved the Retroist a ton of money on the upkeep for the Krampus, eh?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
When have I ever been wrong?
Steven Spielberg presents Gremlins. Billy Pelser has a nice home.
Billy, is that you?
Yeah, Mom, it's me.
A nice job. A nice girl.
If you're not doing anything this Thursday night, maybe you'd like to go out on a date with me?
I'd love to.
And loving parents who are about to give him...
You're gonna like this. No, don't shake it. We're gonna have to open it now. Won't wait till Christmas.
The most unusual gift... he ever got.
What is it?
It's your new pet.
Come on, Barney, be a good dog. My dad gave it to me.
But there are a few things to keep in mind. If you expose it to the light, you may hurt it. If you get it wet, it will multiply.
All that from water? They got wet?
Yeah, plain water.
And most important, no matter how much they beg, never, never let them eat after midnight. Because when they do... they change.
Rafe.
They become clever. Mischievous.
What's going on here?
And dangerous.
Gremlins, huh? Little monsters.
Right.
Hundreds of them.
Well, I don't know, maybe thousands.
They've been here too. Billy, what are these things? Where do they come from?
Look, I know it sounds crazy, I know. But in a few hours, you're gonna have a major disaster on your hands.
Gremlins, directed by Joe Dante. They'll be expecting you.
You know, watching that Gremlins trailer makes me think that our friends from Warpo Toys picked a great time to make a toy line for the Krampus, what with that new movie coming out.
What?
Yeah, man. Didn't I tell you that Michael Dougherty, the guy who directed 2007's Trick or Treat, is releasing the Krampus? This December, naturally. Looks great, and is very much in the Gremlins vein. Anyway, director Richard Donner has had a long career in film and TV, with 79 directing credits like 6 episodes of the original Twilight Zone, and even directing 3 segments of the live-action Danger Island for 1969's The Banana Splits TV show. He directed 1976 classic The Omen, 1978 Superman, and parts of Superman 2. That's a long story. 1982's The Toy, 1987's Lethal Weapon, as well as its 1989, 1992, and 1998 sequels, and 2 other episodes of Tales from the Crypt, to name a few. Frank Darabont, besides being a successful director with the likes of 1999's The Green Mile and 2001's The Majestic, Darabont, though, is also a skilled writer, working on the screenplays for Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors in 1987, then penning the script for 1988's remake of The Blob and 1989's The Fly 2, as well as 5 episodes of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. And he also worked on 1994's adaptation of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Don Rickles has 85 acting credits to his name, with notable roles in TV and film like 1958's Run Silent, Run Deep, the 1961 Twilight Zone episode Mr. Dingle the Strong, 1963's X, The Man with the X-Ray Eyes, 1970's Kelly's Heroes, 37 episodes of CPO Sharky, but for younger fans, he is probably best known for portraying the voice of Mr. Potato Head in the Toy Story films. In fact, his latest credit is listed as being in 2018's Toy Story 4. Bobcat Goldthwait has 90 acting credits, with notable roles in 1985's Police Academy 2, Their First Assignment, as well as 1986's Police Academy 3 and 1987's Police Academy 4. He was also in 1986's excellent One Crazy Summer, 1991's darkly comedic Shakes the Clown, which he also directed, 1994's Radioland Murders, and was in 100 episodes of Unhappily Ever After, where he voiced a fluffy rabbit puppet named Mr. Floppy. Friends, I think that about wraps up this episode. Friends, if you want to know more about Warpo Toys' new toy line, Don't Cuddle the Krampus, I'll be sure to have a link on the podcast post on The Retroist. On behalf of the projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. If you did enjoy the show, we hope you hop on over to The Retroist every Saturday, where we present everything from classic horror TV shows to the best in frightening shorts. The music you hear at the beginning of the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. Our new ending theme is entitled Twisted Toys, and was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud, and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. Of course, I have to give thanks for the invaluable feedback to my co-host, The Projectionist. Where can your fans find you if they wish to contact you?
As you well know, I do not care for current technological standards, but I am sometimes on the Facebooks. Projectionist Haunted Drive-In.
As I mentioned earlier in the show, we do have a Saturday Frights Facebook page as well, and we would greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you, and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. Our podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher, and we would certainly appreciate it if you could click subscribe. Leave us a nice review if you're pleased with our work. I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows, or even feedback, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to The Retroist himself for not only allowing us to record here in The Retroist Vault, but hosting the podcast as well. When you have your retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until next time, the vault is sealed.
Coming soon. Jolting tales of horror. Creepshow. From the author of Carrie, The Shining, and Cujo. And the creator of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. You'll scream at ghastly ghouls. Cringe at weird kids. And shiver at the doings of evil doctors.
This is going to be extremely painful, Mr. Verrill.
Creepshow will grab you, grow on you, and give you the creeps.
No, this is going to be an entirely new experience.
Creepshow, the most fun you'll ever have being scared.
This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye.